Our second of 3 hours underway on this Friday morning in the Mile High City. Sandy Clef with you on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. It is always a pleasure to welcome Dr. Rick Perea, Press and Professor of Sports Psychology, Metro State, University of Colorado. And today, transporting a heavy volume for purposes of my perusing this, let's identify what it is you've given me, Dr. Perea, this morning. The fourth edition, The Foundations of Sport and Exercise Psychology. Robert Weinberg, Daniel Gould are the co-authors. This is a very heavy publication, in more ways than one, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yes, that's the textbook I teach from, Sandy. And I was looking through it yesterday, and I realized this upcoming semester in the fall,
yeah,
I'm going to be teaching from the fifth edition. And so I figured, you know what, I'm going to give this fourth edition to Sandy so he can peruse and look at, and kind of
peruse,
delineate.
Absorb, delineate.
Yeah, absolutely, because that's kind of the Bible of sports psychology and exercise psychology going forward.
You know, we'll cover a lot of ground today, but even as our emphasis later on this hour is going to be placed on the youth in our community, children, in terms of matters relating to sports psychology, how the kids are treated, how the parents react, and you have a lot of thoughts on that. Let's get right off the top of the hour here your thoughts on some of the current events that have transpired since you last visited us here in the studio almost a month ago. Got a fair amount going on. Let's start with what's happened within that month since you were last here with respect to the Denver Nuggets, whose season was over when we last visited. But at that time, every expectation was that in terms of the playing roster, the front office, the head coach, the coaching staff, that things would more or less remain intact. Looking forward to next year. They have not. Why, in your estimation, have the Nuggets figuratively, in some ways literally, come apart at the seams?
Well, first of all, as always, I forgot to say thank you for having me. It's always great to see you, Sandy. Yeah, I think I want to look at this, Sandy, from an industrial organizational perspective. And for people that have never heard me before, I'm an industrial organizational psychologist. And organizational psychologists work with all types of organizations, including sport teams, businesses, you name it. And so when I look at the Nuggets from an organizational perspective, there is a lot of fluid movement that happens within administration. And so it's not, again, all that surprising to me that there has been some movement in the last month. I think if you read between the lines starting back in November and into December, you could see some of the disconnect between Carl and some of the frontline administration and Josh Kroenke and Masai. I think I'm one of those people, obviously I'm a psychologist, but I tend to read between the lines. And I saw some of that disconnect early. And so I think the 57 wins is, you know, quantitative evidence of success. There's no doubt about that. But I think what Kroenke, and this is my opinion, is looking for is not necessarily regular season success. I mean, you want that and you need that to cultivate that winning climate.
Sure.
And essentially get home court advantage is what your goal is. But, you know, where the rubber meets the road is where the playoffs are. I mean, how well you perform in the playoffs. You know, my wife was saying to me this morning, she played volleyball at the University of Alabama and pro indoor, pro outdoor volleyball. So she's an ex-professional athlete. And she said, you know, it doesn't matter really how many wins you have during the season. The trick is to get into the dance. And then that's when you reach your peak performance and play your best. And she reminded me of so many astute coaches I've been around that, you know, essentially, they don't necessarily try to lose games during the season, but they will say, hey, it's not how we're playing in early season, mid-season. It's that we're reaching a peak or a crescendo at the end of the season towards end of the playoffs, so we're playing our best game at that point that takes us deep into the playoffs. So I think where the disconnect was, where Kroenke really wants to go further into the playoffs and attempt to win a championship. But, you know, I keep hearing that 57 wins is a great season. It is. But it's only one aspect or one, you know, quantitative measurement of success. As you know, Sandy, I talk a lot about qualitative assessment. And the qualitative assessment of this deal is it really didn't work out very well. The quantitative is 57 wins, but the qualitative in terms of relationships didn't work out so well. You know there was a disconnect between playing JaVel more minutes, getting him to develop, and using his athleticism to perhaps take this team to a different level. I heard earlier when I was driving in Vic Lombardi say that Kufis outplayed him. And who would you rather have, a consistent player, you know, playing consistently, or JaVel, who's inconsistent? Well, you have to – consistency isn't necessarily everything you're looking for. You're looking for athleticism. You're looking for a player that can make a difference and change the complexion of the game because of his physiological gifts that Kufis does not have. So I think we don't want to necessarily just base it on consistency and competency. It's more about the athleticism and the gifts that JaVel can bring to the floor. And that sometimes brings mistakes, and I understand that. But I think that was the disconnect that started this.
But you have the psychology of the locker room, too.
Mm-hmm.
And George's point seems to be that within the locker room, in terms of promoting a healthy psychology, trust, belief, you had to make McGee earn his minutes. Earn his starting status. And when the competition ensued during the preseason, Kufis proved to be more worthy, not only in the coach's eyes, but apparently in the player's eyes, too. There's also the notion that the team component, who plays together with certain combinations mm-hmm. better than others, that's a factor, too. JaVale McGee and Andre Miller seem to be the two players who provoked the most conversation as to how they're utilized.
Right.
How many minutes they get, starting, coming off the bench, so on and so forth. The sense I get from the players is that Kosta Kufis earned the starting job based on merit. The other sense I get from players is not that Andre Miller is the best nugget by any means, but he seems to be the one guy everybody, including JaVale McGee, wants to play with. If you start JaVale McGee, he doesn't get to play with Andre Miller nearly as much as he does if you bring him off the bench. And this is the point I was trying to make in the first hour. I want to get your reaction to it. The psychology of the locker room, credibility with players. If you hand somebody something he hasn't earned, you lose credibility with players. You lose psychological ground within your own locker room. And the idea that a lot of the reason that goes into determining who plays and who doesn't is how players interact. And it seemed to me this year, although he wasn't their best player, hardly by any means, Andre Miller was the one guy that everybody on the roster seemed to want to play with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Whether they were starting or coming off the bench, they all right. wanted time with Andre Miller.
Right. Well, I think one of the pieces of information we're lacking here, and in psychology, sports psychology, we look at collecting data, analyzing data, and presenting it. We don't know what Josh Kroenke's vision is. We really don't.
Should we?
I think we should. I think we should have more of a clear vision of the direction he's attempting to go. And I think that would go a long way to dispelling some of the speculation that's rampant out here. And so I think his vision, his mission, what he's intending to do with
his vision is not, I want to win a championship, as I said earlier. That's a declaration. That's
right.
not a plan.
Right. And so
everybody wants to win.
Right. Well, but some teams realistically have a chance and some teams realistically do not, too. So I think we need to know that firsthand. And we don't really have that content to analyze this debate whether the Kroenke, it really has a solid ground to stand on. Now, I'll get back to your position about the psychology in the locker room. I think that's important that every player earns their time. They work hard. They're a good teammate. They support each other. There's a belief system. There's a team cohesiveness in that locker room. Absolutely. That's so vitally important. But again, I still think that JaVale McGee's athleticism kind of dispels some of that. I remember when I was playing football, I played around some athletes that were enormously physiologically gifted. And, they didn't necessarily do the right thing or make the right plays or make the right checkdowns, but they made a difference on plays. And coaches would play them because they understood that that would make a difference. And back in that day, it didn't matter what the players, you know, who they wanted to play. That wasn't even part of the process. It doesn't matter who the players want to play with. It's the coach. I mean, the coach has that authority level, that decorum of authenticity that this is me, for me to make decisions, not the other players. So I think that team cohesiveness in the locker room is vitally important by players earning time. But at the same time, players also recognize a player that can make differences on the floor that have nothing to do with the consistency. It's more about their ability to, you know, especially in JaVale's. I mean, JaVale, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, he is really a unique player. He can block shots. He can change shots. He can do things on offense where if you take it in snippets, he does thing on the offensive end that not many players can do either. The trick is to get him to be more consistent with that. And the other players recognize that too. And I think to me, that's kind of where the disconnect was along the line in playing him and developing him. Whereas George Karl, I think, in my opinion, tends to be a guy that wants players to earn their time and develop before they're able to
take
the floor.
But his priority is maximizing wins as opposed to maximizing player development. My confusion with the Nuggets is that they seem to have rejected the person who wanted to win and develop but put a priority on winning, at least right now.
Right. I mean, wouldn't you trade?
And Masai Ujiri, who might have tilted more toward preferring that players be developed, maybe even at the expense of winning a few games, but he's gone too.
Right.
What are you left with?
Right. Well, but
assuming there was conflict, he seems to have rejected the plans of both.
Yeah, and that's what, again, the operative word there
doesn't make any sense.
Seems, right. But again, we need to have more information. But let me say this. Would you trade 57 wins for 48 wins and the Nuggets, let's say, develop more cohesiveness on the floor with an athletic McGee on the floor and they went, you know, they got past the first round, maybe into the second round and got some breaks and maybe got into the Western Conference finals? Would you trade that? Because, I think this team was focused on winning in the regular season and not necessarily in the development, the intrinsic development of the team and certain players that could help them maybe take that next step in the playoffs.
All right, we'll come back and continue with Dr. Rick Perea. We'll talk about what the Broncos have been up to, and it's been more than just running around in their underwear, as John Fox so delicately put it recently. The Broncos very much in the news for having done something that's speaking of the culture of the locker room and leadership issues and who's in charge out of Dove Valley, subjects we've discussed before. I want to get Rick Perea's reaction to the move made this week with respect to Willis McGahee and what that signifies at 10:13. This is Cleft Talk. Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest for this hour on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Sandy Clough. Club Talk on your home for the best live local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Dr. Rick Perea, our guest, and we'll get to Bronco-related subjects momentarily. But I did remember during the break, before we leave the subject of what is going on down at Pepsi Center, there's the Avalanche activity over the last month. We talked, I think, a month ago, either right before or right after Joe Sakic had been officially named as executive vice president hockey operations. What do you think about what's happened since with respect to Patrick Waugh's arrival and his appointment as not only the head coach, but vice president of hockey operations?
Well, at the very least, Andy, it's a very sexy pick. And what
yes,
I mean
it
by, it's a very sexy pick in the sense that, you know, it's a PR move that gets attention to the Avalanche. It's seemingly a lot of credibility. But again, we won't know until the games actually play out because, I mean, does he have the competency? Does he have the acumen as a head coach at this
strangely, he would
level?
Seem to have Waugh more executive experience on the major junior level over the last 8 years than Sakic does.
Right. Yeah. And so, but that's not uncommon in the organization. Sometimes people bring different levels of competencies. And really what is important at the end of the day is that the organization is able to extract the talents and the acumen from each individual that's in that organization. Because some days, I mean, I think with Waugh, he does bring a fiery attitude. He does bring a fiery perception of hey, accountability. We're going to play hard. We're going to give everything we got. Because that's he.
We will
he
have, if
game.
Not a Stanley Cup title by this time next year, he said, we'll have a Stanley Cup attitude. Whether we make the playoffs or not, whether we win the Stanley Cup or not, we will have a Stanley Cup attitude established. He said the day he was officially presented to the media, we will have that firmly established by this time next year.
Right. And that's very important, especially initially in an organization. He's going to have the media's attention, the fans' attention, and the players' attention initially. What's going to be a long-term predictor of his success, though, is if he has the competency and the acumen to make decisions on a systematic, sequential level. Because I'll tell you what, they'll be in the heat of the game. He can't just, you know, get fired up and raise his arousal and anxiety level and control the game that way like he did as a player. He's going to have to be more systematic, more calm, and more, you know, systematic in the way he disseminates decisions, because coaching a team is very different than playing from a team. And I've told you this many times, Sandy, just because you played the game, just because you played a particular sport, doesn't necessarily lead to competency to coach it. Sometimes it does. And you can see the New Jersey Nets are going to give, or actually the Brooklyn Nets, are going to give Jason Kidd an option to do that right after, you know, 6 months after being done with basketball as a player. But again, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But initially, a great move.
Okay. What did the Broncos communicate? What is the significance of their announced decision this week to release Willis McGahee? Undoubtedly, one who made a tangible on-field contribution, and even during times when he wasn't playing or when he was hurt, still regarded as a leader providing intangibles. He's released this week. What does that say to you about what the Broncos are doing, where they're headed, who's in charge, what the psychology is out of Dove Valley coming out of last season?
Yeah, I read the newspaper article this morning, and I hear the things that John Fox is saying. I hear the things that everyone in that organization is saying. And again, let's be core honest here. We don't always get the truth from coaches, from administrators. They tell the media, they tell us some of what we need to know, and then there's some they do not tell us. I mean, I don't think they're
going to... Do you believe Fox when he says his absence from the OTAs had nothing to do with the decision?
No.
You don't believe him?
No, absolutely not. I think that has something to do with it, because when a player is... I mean, him and Clady were the only ones that were absent, correct?
Right.
Okay, and Clady has...
Clady hasn't signed his deal yet.
And so Clady has some other reasons why, some logistic reasons. But, you know, McGahee was the only player that wasn't there, quote-unquote, for voluntary OTAs.
Correct.
That sent a nonverbal message, okay, to the rest of the team that he didn't think he had to be there, and he's different. One of the things that Elway has clearly tried to establish with this organization is climate and culture of accountability. And that flies in the face of accountability. For whatever the reason, whether it's family reasons, as I heard, or whatever the purposes are, you know, this is big boy football. You need to get your butt here. And if you're not here, that sends a message to the young blood on that team. So while Fox and Elway may say the politically correct thing that it had nothing to do with being absent from OTAs, okay, I think absolutely it had a lot to do with it. But it also has to do with this contract. I mean, they wanted to free up some money. There's no doubt about it. But I think that kind of message sends a clear signal, verbally, vocally, non-verbally, to the rest of the team that this is a different level of accountability. If you're on board, grab a paddle and start paddling. But if you're not...
And you're saying Monte Ball, in their estimation, was exhibiting those tendencies more so than Willis McGahee, that he was emphatically endorsed by Peyton Manning. Monte Ball, his work habits, Manning going out of his way to say, hey, I'm spending time working with him after practice, he's right there with me.
Yeah. Well, you know, Monte Ball and Hillman, those guys are young blood, and they're the wolf climbing the hill, okay? You know, theoretically, McGee was the wolf at the top of the hill. What happens to the wolf when the wolf is at the top of the hill? They turn around and kind of relax a little bit. But the wolf climbing the hill is alert, is focused, is working hard. And those two young bloods are the wolf climbing the hill. And that's what the Broncos want, is a focus level that really says, hey, every day matters. Every minute, every practice matters. And you hear Manning talk about these things, and that's being reinforced with Elway. And this message...
Whether OTAs are voluntary or mandatory, Manning, the coaches, Elway seem to be communicating. It all matters.
It all matters.
Whether it's voluntary or mandatory, it matters.
And this message, I think, set a clear climate and culture of, if you're not on board and grabbing a paddle and paddling, you're gone. Because that's just what we're trying to do here. So I think it's a message that reverberates through the whole organization clearly and consistently.
You like it.
Yes.
You like it.
Yes.
You know, we can debate the merits of the football move, but in terms of setting a tone, Sal Palantonio again reporting this week that Elway has addressed the players and said more or less, I want all of you to be a little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And that, in organizational context, Sandy, that is a recipe for success. Structure, discipline, and accountability. Absolutely. And when you let a player go who essentially is an employee of that organization, let's not forget that, okay? I think fans forget that the Broncos are an organization. When you let go that employee of that organization for not participating in a voluntary practice, you are sending a strong message that we expect everyone's 100% full commitment every minute, every day, every month, until we achieve our ultimate goal, and that's winning the Lombardi Trophy.
All right, we'll move on to the subject of the day that Dr. Pariah wanted to get into, youth, children, sports psychology, parents, coaches on the youth level, what they are doing, what they are not doing, what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. That's just ahead on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. Dr. Rick Perry, our in-studio guest, as Club Talk continues. Sandy Clef with you on Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best Latin local sports talk, Denver Sports Station. And we continue. Lines open at 303-228-1043 if you want to jump in. Total Beverage text line 29588. But you say this is one of your students' favorite topics. Youth, children, sports psychology, youth sport, in your estimation. And I'll summarize what I think is your general position, then you can get into the specifics. Youth sport being professionalized, moving from physical, social, psychological development to more extrinsic goals such as winning, rankings, college scholarships. Explain exactly what you mean by that.
Yeah, what I mean, Sandy, is youth sports are largely being professionalized in America because our emphasis is on winning. And when you look at the original vision or mission of youth sport, it was to develop youth in terms of their psychological health, their social development, and obviously their physiological or sporting competencies. That's clear. But what worries me, Sandy, is, for example, recently I was coaching my son's JAM basketball team, and they're 9 to 10-year-olds.
Right.
And we walked into the gym, and this is a competitive league, and I understand that. But from the opening tip to obviously halftime, we take the break, and then the end of the game, the opposing coach started yelling the whole game. I mean, and I'm not exaggerating. I'm really not. And just yelling at the kids, press, 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 and just constantly. And what that does is it doesn't allow an autonomous situation for the athletes to make mistakes on their own and learn from those. So we've largely emphasized winning at the expense of psychological, social, and physiological development. I mean, over 45 million kids or youth play sports in America today, Sandy. And between the ages of 10 and 13, 4 in 10 of those will drop out. And some of that's to natural attrition, like they don't like the sport or they're not competent in that area. But we see a lot of kids dropping out of sport because of burnout. And we can attribute it to two main areas when we talk about research. Largely, it's their own perception of competence, okay? How they perceive they are either a good player or a bad player. Now, where do they get this information from? Largely from coaches and parents. And one of the things we've seen an increase over the last 20 years is parents seem to be, quote unquote, overly involved in their athletes' participation. And coaches call this helicopter parents. They hover. They come to every practice. They videotape practice. They come to every game. Going to games and matches, that's all fine. You know, you have a daughter that competes. I had a daughter that competed.
Sure.
That's fine. But when you go to every single practice and you're filming practice in the intent of analyzing their performance, then I think that begins to become overboard and really kind of increase the anxiety of the particular athlete. And again, let's talk about psychological competencies at 10 to 13. The brain is not fully developed until approximately 24 to 25 years of age. The upper cortical structures of the brain, the frontal lobes, are not developed. So we are sending strong messages to children that they have perceived competence or not at such a young age that oftentimes they perceive themselves as not having worthy in the sport because the emphasis is winning championships, trophies, awards, as opposed to just social, psychological, and physiological development.
And you're saying, too, here that when it comes to coaches, coaching youth, a very different proposition from what we were talking about the first 30 minutes with you in studio today, coaching adults.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes those differences aren't readily apparent to those doing the coaching on the youth level.
Yes. Unfortunately, Sandy, what we have very often is you have parents coaching youth teams. Now, I'm not saying across the board that's a problem. I think there are some parents that are capable of coaching kids, but most of them are not. I mean, in teaching, we talk about pedagogical delivery systems, and that's a fancy word for how people teach. Post 18 years of age, we call that andragogy. People need to understand that coaching youth is a different skill set than coaching adults. I mean, youth, developmentally speaking, they're not able to process to the levels that we do at the adult level. But coaches are using some of the same procedures and protocols to coach youth that they use at an adult level. And that's clearly not effective. So I think it's important to understand that parents who have youth that play sport, that they need to understand whatever club or high school or team they're playing for, that the coaches do have some education as to how to communicate. Let me give you one example that I've dealt with recently, and that is a high school athlete that I'm working with. And really, this goes for several high school athletes that I work with. And some of their coaches, when they're coaching them, whether it's their high school coach or their club coach, will make a statement such as this. They'll say, by golly, you know, you really are doing a great job. You're working hard. You have all the physical tools. Your problem is in your head. Now, think about that statement, Sandy. When you say that to an athlete, the problem is in your head, you have given them the content to believe it's in their head. So whether it is in their head or not, that should never be communicated to a youth athlete because they can't process at a higher level of cognitive processing to be able to say, well, I understand what they're meaning. No, they'll walk away thinking, oh my gosh, is there something wrong with me? And so they can internalize this, and thus that affects their performance, and they start to believe it's in their head. So we have to do a much better job in the sport psychological world of educating youth coaches some of the simple things they think are helping athletes but are actually handicapping them.
The well-intentioned desire would seem to be to motivate.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And whether it comes out well or not, we'll assume the motivation is, in most cases, well-intentioned.
Oh, yeah.
That they mean well. But you have some means listed here in what you've presented to me today to try to get more out of kids who are interested in getting better, very much driven to improve their own performance.
Yes, absolutely. These are protocols and practice of how to coach someone that's in their youth ages that will really help them maximize and become intrinsically motivated. We've talked about intrinsic motivation in this situation before. We talked about extrinsic. Intrinsic and extrinsic are fancy words for internal and external. So, for example, to become an intrinsically rewarded athlete means that's going to sustain itself. It's going to last over time because you do it because of the love of the game.
Yeah.
Extrinsic motivation means that you're doing it for external rewards, to please your parents, to please your coach, for awards, for money, for a scholarship, something like that. So here's an example. Number one, these are ways to cultivate intrinsically motivated youth that really are playing the game because they love it. Encourage and reward effort, not the outcome. So, for example, if you have a basketball player and he goes out there in the game and he misses a three, don't sit up in the stands and shake your head non-verbally or put your hands in your face, because that athlete can look up in the stands and see that you're disappointed with
Absolutely.
The result. It's not the result. It's the effort. So when you talk to them after a game, I advise parents to say, hey, great game, great effort. Didn't matter that the ball would go in. It'll go in next time. And because if you reward the result, the athlete is going to start to perceive that, my gosh, I have to perform to be accepted. But if you reward the effort, then that says to them that, you know what, all I have to really do here is play hard and the results will come. Number two, do not attend all practices and training sessions. I mean, I really mean this, okay? It's fine if you attend all the games. That's great. I did that with my daughter. But don't go to every practice. Why? I mean, you know, hopefully you have something else to do in your life and spend your time. Practice is where they learn social skills. They learn physiological skills. They learn, you know, so many different skills. One of the great things about youth sports, Andy, is you learn, you meet people. You exchange ideas with different people. You learn from people of different cultural backgrounds. Let them do that on their own so they don't always have to glance over at you.
For approval. No.
External validation is what we call it in psychology.
Right.
So
you've got three other points to make. We'll let you make those points when we continue. 10:43, Sandy Clef with you. Dr. Rick Perea, our in-studio guest, making his once-a-month house call on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. It is 10:49 on your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Sandy Clef, Dr. Rick Perea, our guest in studio. And you had other points to make regarding ways in which parents, basically, right, can take their youngsters already motivated to succeed and better serve them.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we as parents have choices to place our children in particular clubs, and we can choose levels of competence.
Absolutely.
And you should demand that these coaches have some kind of level of training or acumen in terms of coaching the athlete's developmental level. So if they're 13 years old, the coaches need to understand what they're capable of accomplishing from a cognitive perspective or a physiological perspective. There's certain things that they're just not capable of at that age. The other thing is they need to emphasize the life lessons that we learn in sports. I mean, my gosh, what an opportunity to meet people from different cultural backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and not always worry about winning awards and championships. You know, we have some friends that their kid plays baseball, and I think every time my wife talks to them, they're gone on some trip. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But I think it's more about the social development, the aspect of learning a little bit about each other, not so much on winning, because you know what, Sandy, the statistics are pretty startling. Of all these youth, these 45 million youth that play sports in America, I mean, less than 3% of those will ever get a partial athletic scholarship, and close to 1% of those athletes will get a full Division I athletic scholarship. So I think if parents are doing it for many of these external rewards, that they're really kind of playing against the odds. And what we really should aim for is for athletes to be developed from a psychological, healthy perspective.
All right. You've got, obviously, and you touched on this before, the idea that you put emphasis on the life lessons as opposed to winning awards, championships. And again, back to the idea, you turn your athlete at practice over to the coach.
Yes.
Don't meddle.
Yes.
And you had an experience in mini camp, training camp for the Broncos back 30 years ago, didn't you?
Absolutely.
On this point.
Yes. I remember coming out of college. I didn't get drafted, but I had the opportunity to be signed as a free agent. And I had several teams that wanted to sign me as a free agent. And my first thought was to sign with Seattle. Seattle was a team that had offered me a free agent contract. And, you know, I told that to my mom, and my mom, in her good interest, she says, well, you know, Denver wants to sign you. Why not sign here? You're from Denver. You went to George Washington High School, played here. Why wouldn't you? You know, we could watch you play that way. And, you know, at 21 years of age, again, my brain not fully developed, I didn't have all the analytical skills to make decisions that really would, you know, make sense. So I decided if I was going to be in a training camp, that why not be here in Denver? Well, here's the inherent problem. And of course, I 2020, you know, hindsight's always 2020. But going to training camp, we were in mini camp at the old facility way back in time up at 56 and I-25. But, you know, we had mini camp, and then we had organized practices between mini camp and training camp, and then training full training camp up in Greeley. At every single training camp practice, I had probably 5 to 10 friends there.
Yeah.
I had media there that were saying, hey, here's a local kid. There, you know, I had 3 or 4 stories done on me. And I honestly can say that all that attention, while some people may simplistically think, wow, that's great, you have a lot of attention, I felt like I was in a fishbowl. I felt like I was under the microscope, that everything I did was being examined. So after every practice, whether it was a morning or afternoon practice, I'd come off the field and bless them. To their, you know, my parents were there, my friends. But I just didn't have that feeling of being independent and going out and just letting it loose and being who I could be independently. So I can only imagine what young athletes must feel like when you have parents who film every practice. And that just can be overwhelming content for a youth to have to deal with.
A few other texts. I want to get your quick reaction on our final minutes here. From the 303, most parents should never attend practice past a certain age. Always get to know the coach and pop in from time to time.
Yes, that's a very healthy assertion because, again, practice is for coaches and for players. Turn them over to the coaches. Don't meddle. Don't have a hand signal little, you know, protocol on the sidelines, giving them hand signals, telling them what to do. That's the coach's job. You know, when my daughter was playing soccer at Cherry Creek High School, I'll never forget this, Sandy. There was right in the middle of a match, there was a mom that was really encouraging her daughter by saying things like, go, go, go. And her daughter stops right in the middle of the soccer games and said, Mom, and I'll use a more, you know, appropriate term here, but she says, Mom, would you flippin' shut up? And time stood still. The whole place heard it. And the point was, Mom, back off.
Yeah.
Let me play. So,
absolutely. From the 303, situational leadership means managing individuals in accordance with their level of experience and ability in relation to the task, so one size doesn't fit all.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, all these athletes are different, male, female, yeah, younger, older. They're different. But what we need to recognize as parents and coaches is let them make some of their own mistakes from an autonomous perspective. Stop coaching them as parents. Let the coach coach them. And then as coaches, understand their competencies psychologically, physiologically, and socially, and let them kind of navigate that world on their own. Don't, I mean, if you attend a practice here and there, that's understandable. But don't film practices. Yeah. I mean, that's just really over the top, and it can put a lot of pressure, thus increasing the anxiety level of the athlete.
And I want to get a quick reaction to this. From the 303, the best decision a high school coach can make is closing practice. Mere fact they have to make that decision is just pathetic. That's from Matty B.
Yeah, it is pathetic. A high school coach would have to close practice. But if it gets to that point in this hyper-competitive society, Sandy, which bleeds over into professional sports, as we've seen, that may be what's coming.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you, Sandy.
And again, give people the essential information. If they want to follow up on some of this, how do they contact you, communicate with you?
Yeah, they can reach me at Dr. P at dk2motivation.biz, or they can look me up under Metro or CU, and my email address is there. They can look me up, and I'd be happy to help them. But more than anything, Sandy, I want to wish you a happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
To all the fathers out there,
appreciate
it's always a pleasure, and I'll see you next month.
We'll see you next month. George Carl is up ahead. Dr. Rick Perea in studio for the past hour as Club Talk rolls on. This is your home for the best live and local sports talk, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan.